there are just some weeks when we preachers kind of can't believe our luck, because the scripture reading set for the day and the front page news of the week just line up perfectly, and the message seems clear, and the sermon looks like it's going to almost write itself. So here we are this Sunday with scripture readings about toxic ambitions and disciples jockeying for position and arguing over who is the greatest. And what happens? There's a leadership coup in the federal government, and the Prime Minister is challenged and dumped in favour of his ambitious long-term rival. Too easy. Actually, it is too easy. It's so easy that it'd be really easy to get it completely wrong. It's always easy to write and preach sermons that point out the foibles and failings of other people, especially high-profile and famous other people. But the truth is that if our reading of the scriptures leaves us feeling smugly superior to those terrible other people, there's every likelihood that we've missed the point somewhere. And I could feel myself sailing off down that path when I first began to contemplate how I would preach this week. As we heard tonight, Jesus called his followers together and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." It would be so easy to illustrate the opposite of that from federal politics. And the Apostle James tells us tonight that where there is envy and selfish ambition, there will be disorder and wickedness of every kind. No trouble illustrating that from the week in politics either. And he continues saying, "But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace for those who make peace." It would be lovely to claim that for ourselves in contrast to those foolish and fractious politicians. Jesus also continued, taking a little child and hugging her warmly in front of his disciples and saying to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." When our politicians on both sides of the house are willing to lock up children in immigration detention centres in order to win the votes of a racist, hostile and self-interested sectors of the public, it would be so easy to vilify them and portray ourselves as the ones who always welcome children and in them welcome Jesus and the one who sent him. But if we take seriously what's going on in these scripture readings, especially in the gospel reading, we will realise that the people that it is asking us to take a good hard look at are ourselves. This gospel reading is about the followers of Jesus missing the point. It's about the followers of Jesus not understanding what Jesus is trying to tell them about the countercultural nature of his leadership, and instead jockeying for position and trying to set themselves up to be winners in the polls and in the race for fame and power and influence. And whenever the gospel gives us pictures of the disciples getting it wrong, it's challenging us to see ourselves in those disciples and to take a very honest and searching look at ourselves, asking whether we're really doing any better. Mark, the gospel writer, was quite deliberate in the way that he linked this incident with the stories around it. First, he tells us that Jesus has been spending some time alone with the disciples, away from the crowds, so that he could provide them with some really important teaching. And Mark's summary of that teaching tells us that Jesus was saying to them, "The Son of Man is to be betrayed into human hands, and they will kill him, and 3 days after being killed, he will rise again." But, Mark tells us, they did not understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask. You've got to feel for the disciples a bit here. They've gotten used to Jesus speaking in parables and riddles, and they're getting into the habit of looking for the interesting twist or the hidden meaning. So when Jesus starts saying quirky things like, "The Son of Man will be killed and 3 days later will rise again," it's no surprise that they're not expecting him to be stating the straightforward, literal truth. But it's not just that they're expecting a riddle or a parable, is it? What Jesus is saying is almost beyond comprehension. And not just because he talks about someone rising from the dead. Shortly before this incident, Peter has identified Jesus as the Messiah. And the expectations of how the Messiah would act and what he would do varied considerably, but all the versions involved powerful leadership and forceful victories over the enemies of God's people. Being a winner was basic to the job description of the Messiah. None of the various expectations had much room for the idea of a Messiah being defeated and killed by his opponents, whatever might come after that. No wonder the disciples were looking for hidden meanings. So when they begin arguing about which of them is the greatest, it simply illustrates the nature of what they don't understand. Isn't being a leader about greatness, about the competitive exercise of power and influence? Sure, it's rare for any leader to be popular with everyone all of the time. This week's episode in the Parliamentary Liberal Party saw much of the discussion and debate about who was the most or the least popular with who. Malcolm Turnbull was able to pitch his claim for leadership on the basis of his popularity with the general population, despite the fact that he was a lot less popular with significant sections of his own party. Tony Abbott was more popular within the party, but in the end, those within the party concluded that the most important thing was the ability to win. And winning in politics depends on the ability to appeal to the voters. And on that score, Tony Abbott was increasingly being seen as a loser. Which, when you think about it, doesn't sound all that different from the attitudes of the disciples of Jesus. And perhaps we're not too different either. Who will we give our support to? Who will we vote for? Who will we recognise as a leader who's worth following? Do we too measure our leaders according to their ability to come out on top, to win the popularity polls and the performance indicators, to defeat their opponents, perhaps even to humiliate their opponents? Take note too that while Jesus sometimes says that he will be handed over to the religious and political leaders, on this occasion he simply says that he will be betrayed into human hands. That's not just unpopular with rival leaders. That's about us and the disciples and everyone being unable to recognise him as a viable leader who is worth following. We don't want a loser for a leader. But Jesus is undeterred. His bewildering and unexpected style of leadership is not about winning in the world's usual power games. Jesus is not aiming to out-muscle the alternative leaders, which is why the likes of Pontius Pilate couldn't understand what he was on about when he spoke of a kingship that wasn't of this world. A kingship or a leadership that wasn't about competition and defeating rivals was simply incomprehensible. So if you're excited about those who want to set up Christian political parties or Christian political lobby groups to ensure that Christian values and Christian agendas stand a chance of defeating their rivals in the nation's political systems, sorry, but you're probably not going to find much of an ally in Jesus. Jesus has never seemed much interested in playing the political game to gain advantages and to advance his capacity to impose his agendas on the wider society. In fact, that was precisely one of the offers made to him by the Satan in the wilderness, which Jesus rejected as a temptation that was seeking to turn him away from his true mission. But none of this is to say that Jesus is solely interested in some kind of detached spiritual realm and that his leadership has no implications for the worlds of politics and power. Jesus' teachings and examples have at least as much to say to our approach to politics as to anything else. His teaching and an example are a huge challenge not only to our voting intentions, but to the whole way that we do politics, both on the national stage and in our churches and communities. To Jesus, it seems, as soon as our political strategies become about vanquishing or opposing or defeating others, we've already lost our way. We've become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. When Jesus embraced the child and spoke of welcoming the child as the model for leadership, he wasn't saying that you should set out to defeat and destroy those whose policies disadvantage children. He was saying something far more than that. He was also saying that such adversarial power games are part of what destroys the world that our children are going to inherit. The answer does not lie in trying to one-up one another with the quality of our child-friendly policies, but in becoming the kind of people who would much rather join hands in the playful company of children than climb over one another on our way to the top. But are we any more ready to recognise and honour such strange leadership than the disciples were? Because for the most part, on the odd occasions when we see such playful, joyous, bridge-building leadership, we dismiss it with faint praise. We say it's very lovely, but that it's rather naive and utopian, and we quickly turn back looking for strong leaders and influential movers and shakers, winners. But Jesus won't play our power games. And he certainly won't validate our attempts to co-opt God into our power games and to claim that God is on our side against our opponents. Jesus reveals to us the face of a God whose only true enemy is enmity itself, and who would rather allow himself to be crushed in the grinding wheels of power than surrender to becoming such a power wielder. But despite clearly knowing that such a radical refusal to conform to the political norms would result in a loss of public support and death at the hands of a coalition of angry opponents, Jesus also knew that death does not have the last word. He knew that real life, the life that is really worth living, is only reached by travelling a thoroughly non-conformist pathway that may result in rejection, suffering, and death. Real life in the wide open spaces of God's love can be found on no other path. Back in February, Tony Abbott spoke of a near-death experience when he was almost dumped. And now, presumably, he has tasted what he would regard as the full death experience. Perhaps in this death, for him, the gateway to real life lies open before him. May he and all of us have the grace and courage and childlike playfulness to follow Jesus through that gateway and into real love and life.